Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much.
So right now we are in the midst of the World Cup for football, or as some Americans call it, soccer. Frank, are you watching the World Cup?
This is a good question.
Yeah, on most World Cups, that would be like a no-brainer question, but this one is a complicated one.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. Okay. I mean, I have to confess, I think I said on social media when this thing was starting, I have little or no interest in it, and I'm not excited about it. And I think that remains true. I will say my son is very excited and has... His excitement is contagious and induced us to watch a few matches. It's tough because of where it is. It's in Qatar. There's all kinds of, well, we know that there was all kinds of chicanery and corruption involved in the awarding of the World Cup to Qatar. FIFA is a very, the world governing body of, because we're an American history podcast, yeah. I'm going to do what's unnatural to me because I've lived here for 30 years. I think we should call it soccer.
Okay, I was going to ask you that question. We'll get into the nomenclature later.
And we might want to distinguish between soccer and what Americans call football anyway. So for the purposes of this discussion, it's going to be soccer and football because we're an American history podcast, a U.S. history podcast.
Yes.
So FIFA, the governing body of world soccer, is a pretty corrupt and awful institution, and there's a lot of this isn't my opinion.
There's
a lot of evidence to support this view, and so the awarding of the World Cup to Qatar has a bit of a stink around it, and then we know that as many as 6,500 people, that might be a high estimate, but certainly a significant number of very very poorly compensated laborers died building the stadia that the World Cup is being played in. So there are all kinds of problems associated with, and the Qatar regime, there have been debates and disputes about whether people can express support for gay rights, for example, during or around the games. This is a deeply problematic World Cup in all kinds of ways.
They weren't going to serve beer after saying they were going to serve beer? Right?
So yeah, all kinds I'm less concerned about the beer. It is Budweiser, so it's not really beer.
Fair point.
there are all kinds of problems with this one. Now, I spoke to a friend last night who's a highly ethical person and somebody whose opinions I respect a lot.
Not me.
Well, you are a highly ethical person whose opinions I respect, but it wasn't you in this case. And I asked her views on this, and she said two things. She said, first of all, if this was an attempt at sport washing by Qatar, and it was, it's gone fantastically wrong, and therefore you can watch it because it's kind of blown up in their faces. I would qualify that slightly and say, well, at least in the Western media, that's the case. Actually, particularly in the Middle East, there's been an interesting kind of rallying around of Qatar over the criticism it's received. But so she said that, and I thought that's a good point. And secondly, her son, a big football fan, well known to me, or soccer fan, who now lives in the States, in fact, had the view, and this is an incredibly optimistic view, and in fact, we might want to challenge it in the course of our conversation today, that football is usually a force for good, even despite FIFA, and therefore it's okay to watch it. And the principles behind this about countries coming together, et cetera, are okay. So there's another real problem with this if you're a soccer fan, which is it's coming at the wrong time of year. Normally the World Cup is played in the summertime, which at least in the Northern Hemisphere summer, which is also the off season or the close season for Northern Hemisphere soccer. And now it's interrupted the middle of the season. And so there are problems there too. So I had very little enthusiasm. I have watched a little bit. I have not watched as much as I would have watched in the past.
Now, okay, you're probably watching more than I am because as listeners will find out over the rest of this episode, Frank is a robust soccer / football fan.
Yes, yeah.
You have enthusiasm for the sport and have had for many years. I, by comparison, have played a bit as a kid, coached my kids' teams a bit, but am a relative neophyte when it comes to this topic. I'm not watching any of this and probably wouldn't have watched it even if it was not in this particular location with all the problems. How is the American team doing?
The U.S. team's done well. They beat Iran last night, and so if you're watching this, if you're listening to this, it's now Wednesday when we're recording it. So the United States men's team beat Iran last night after drawing with England, and so they emerged from their group, and they will be playing over the weekend in the knockout stage, the final 16. They'll be playing the Netherlands, which will be tough, but not impossible. I mean, they looked pretty good. I did not see the game last night against Iran because I was having dinner with the person. We were having dinner with the person who I was asking the question about the ethics of this. I didn't see that match, but I did see the England game, and they played pretty well against England.
Okay, so that's a very lengthy introduction to the topic of our episode, which is soccer/football in the United States, and how do we make sense of it. So should we deal with the nomenclature thing first? The rest of the world calls this football. Americans call it soccer. Why?
Okay, this is a very interesting... You'd think this is trivial. It's not. It's a very interesting question. And in fact, at the England-US game last week, the American fans were chanting, "It's called soccer," to taunt the English fans, which is actually quite funny. In that sing-songy, "It's called soccer." So the American fans basically don't have as many good chants as the English do. I think that's a fair statement, but I think that's pretty funny. Interestingly, and I'm relying here, and some of the information I'm going to share with you today comes from a PhD student of mine who I need to name and credit now, named Paul McFarlane. And Paul's doing he's writing a really interesting PhD on Scottish football and the influence of Scottish footballers in the United States and Canada at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century.
Oh.
And so Paul's done some really interesting work. And so a lot of what I'm going to say today about that period, I've learned from reading Paul's really interesting work. And we should interview him sometime because he's really, really good on all this stuff. One of the things Paul came up with, and he's demonstrated this to my satisfaction at least, is he calls it soccer in his own research because people in the 19th century called it soccer. Hmm. So football, at least in the English-speaking world, is a slightly later usage. And the reason it's called soccer is because it's short for association football.
Okay.
So the sock comes from the word association.
Yeah.
And it's a shorthand. It became a shorthand in the 19th century, again, in the Anglophone world, and we're talking about Britain now, to distinguish it from rugby.
Okay, because I found... So you have rugby soccer and association...
You have rugby football and
association football.
Right.
Okay.
So there are two codes of rugby. We don't really have to get into this. So there are multiple versions of what... So what happens in the 19th century that's really interesting, we see parallels in U.S. sports, particularly with baseball, is in the... You get all kinds of experimentation in the first half of the 19th century. In the second half, you get people codifying things and writing down rules and trying to make sense of it. People have been kicking balls for as long as there have been balls,
right?
And coming up with games. But they're trying to codify the rules in the latter half of the 19th century. And what we see emerge in Britain and in the United States, elsewhere, just around the world, is a codification. And where... what we call soccer is concerned, the British, particularly the English, codify the set of rules that becomes the international norm, at least at that period. And it's called association football to distinguish it from rugby. A lot of people will know that. I mean, that's kind of that is a kind of Trivial Pursuit question. But what's interesting, at least based on my reading of Paul's research, is that he claims, and again, I have no reason to disagree with him, he's done the work, that this usage is widely used on both sides of the Atlantic in the 19th and early 20th century. So soccer is, so those fans who I'm sure really are really interested in the history of words who were chanting that were really making a profoundly well-informed comment when they were chanting at the English fans.
Well, I think it's intriguing that the term soccer then is not an American term. It's a British term that gets used in America, and it's a British term that British people use to distinguish football from rugby.
Right.
You know,
so
it actually has...
And then it maps nicely on in the United States because, of course, the United States has its own code of football, which in the late 19th century was very similar to rugby. you know, the forward passes, we don't have to get into this, but the evolution of the forward pass the development of the forward pass is the key evolutionary moment when what becomes American football deviates from rugby. It's a term that allows, you know, it allows Americans, U.S. people in the United States to make a distinction between their code of football and this different code of football. So soccer's in common parlance in the late 19th, early 20th centuries when it's adopted. And as is so often the case, you know, in American English in certain ways is more archaic than British English in some of its usages. And this is a good, like the fall as opposed to autumn.
Sure.
And so this is another case of that. Now, so that's probably more than you wanted.
But no. I think that's fascinating. Because I was trying to find that out too, and it did seem like there's this very convoluted linguistic switching that's going on in Oxford when they're trying to figure out how to call, you know, a variety of different games, and everyone's trying to say, oh, well, we all play football, but we all mean different things by it, so we have to have different names.
I mean, it is ironic now because soccer is closely associated with the United States and Canada, with English in North America, and not widely used as a term elsewhere, a little bit in Australia. Where they have multiple codes of football. They have lots of different codes of football in Australia. And so it is used in the Antipodes too. But because football makes sense. And certainly when soccer becomes a global game in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, it's almost inevitably in almost every other language called football.
Sure.
And of course, it makes sense as football. Mm.
Much more so than American football
right,
makes sense as football.
Right, yeah, because the kicking aspect of American football is actually kind of more peripheral now.
Yes. So, if we're going to, I think it seems like soccer probably has the same kind of vague history as baseball does. We're nailing down an origin point in the United States is, you know, almost impossible. But if you were to say, when does soccer begin in the United States, when would you... Where would you point us to?
Well, David, I'm happy you asked that. And I'm going to ask you a trivia question, but the answer I think will be obvious. So do you know when the United States... when the United States had its first professional soccer league?
I want to say it's in the 1890s?
You would be correct. So it's 1894.
Okay.
But, and again, all credit to Paul McFarlane for this. I didn't know this till I read his lit review. Mm. I mean, soccer historians knew this, and Paul knows it. But I don't want to pass this off as my own knowledge. In 1894, the owners of the National League in Baseball created a soccer league. And interestingly...
It's a bad year to start a soccer league.
Well, yeah, but it's the third professional soccer league in the world.
Really?
England was first, the FA in England. Mm. Scotland was second with the creation of the SFA, the Scottish Football Association, creating a league structure. And the United States was third. So when you, well, you're not putting on the World Cup to hear this, but when you hear people describe the United States as Johnny come latelys and they don't know anything about this game, et cetera, at least when it came to professionalization, they were third in the world and only a few years after the Scots and the English. The reason for this, I think, again, has to do with the cultural similarities, the creation of sports, the codification of sports I was referring to. It's not that other people aren't playing football or versions of it at that time. I don't want to go too far. Interestingly, the National League owners created this short-lived league. It only existed for a year in 1894 because they wanted two things. They wanted their players to play in it. They wanted it to be off-season fitness training.
Nice. Okay.
Which makes sense. And they also, many of them, of course, were building ballparks and spaces which they wanted used.
So then you want something that's in the baseball offseason.
Okay. It's in the baseball offseason, and it's something the players can do. So they create this. And then there's a more formal league that's created. A semi-professional league emerges in 1895 that lasts for about 25 years. So, but, you know, you can't have a league. We learned this with baseball. You don't create a league out of nothing.
Right.
You know, it's not a big bang, right? I mean, something has to precede it. So clearly, you know, the men who owned those National League teams in the 1890s were businessmen. They saw an opportunity. So people are playing soccer in some form, to an extent that they think this. Now, it was a bad business idea because it didn't succeed, but it's not a crazy business idea, if that makes sense.
No, I think that that moment's an interesting moment to think about. Obviously, it's a bad year to start a new sports league because there's a huge financial crisis going on.
It's a bad year to start
anything. So they made a bad choice there. Maybe they were desperate. Maybe that's why they made the choice. But that's a time in which, you know, baseball is a relatively new professional sport. It's been around for 20 years as a professional sport at that point, and that, you know, there are a bunch of rogue leagues and new leagues being formed in baseball all the time in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, the Players League and the Union League and all these other.
And they often fold.
Yeah. Some of them are, you know, do well for a season or two and then collapse. So who's playing on these teams other than off-season baseball players?
Well, in terms of that first league, we don't know very much about it because it didn't exist very long. And the semi-professional league that emerges is mainly based, and it's going to be an antecedent to the next really serious professional league in the United States. It's mainly based in the Northeast, so it's mainly in the kind of New York, New England area. And it's around mill towns, and it's closely associated with not just immigrant workers, but a lot of immigrants. And again, Paul's work has showed this in terms of Scottish immigrants playing soccer and starting leagues, and in urban areas. So you get it in the Northeast. You get teams around Chicago. You get teams around in the Greater Toronto area, for example, in North America. So what you're getting are. Playing seems to be very closely associated. That's with baseball in the same period, with kind of both urban areas, but particularly industrialization. And so you get a combination of native-born U.S. citizens and immigrants playing.
That's fascinating because I think that, I mean, my impression is that during the same time in Britain, a lot of mill towns are also the places where football is really, popular. And so I guess maybe immigrants who are coming from one to the other, bringing the game with them. And
that's right. And again, I'm drawing on Paul's research here. He's found, you know, he's looked at naming patterns. So you get, Chicago Thistle, you get, he's found lots of Scottish either place names or kind of team names that are directly associating with the Scottish diaspora. And he happens to be looking at Scotland and Scottish football and its influence on the United States. But there's certainly a parallel. You get a lot in the Jersey City area among Irish immigrants, for example. And there's a long tradition in Jersey City and that part of New Jersey going. There's a kind of through line that runs to today. That's a real soccer hotbed in the United States to this day.
I mean, one thing that's striking about soccer, and one thing that makes it both accessible to people and obviously part of the reason why it's so popular around the world is that the barrier to entry, if you want to play soccer, all you need is a ball and a field.
Yep.
You know, and compared to other sports, even compared to, you know, baseball, which doesn't need a lot of stuff, you need at least a few things in order to play baseball. Whereas, you know, soccer is, you know, which helps explain why in mill towns in relatively poor urban communities, they're able to play this sport and why it has so popular. So, they have this professional league in the 1890s that doesn't work out. And there's a bunch of other league. When does soccer seem to catch on?
Right. The first serious professional league, I think, is the American Soccer League, which exists from 1921 to 1933.
Okay.
And
also bad timing.
It is, but this is a fascinating, really fascinating league. And it's a fascinating moment in the history of sport in the United States. Because, of course,
it's the golden age of baseball.
It's the golden age of baseball. It's when boxing and horse racing are so popular. The NFL traces its earliest roots if it just celebrated a centenary. So at approximately the same time, the American Soccer League is created, and one of its founders proclaims, and this is something we'll hear over the next century, that soccer is poised to become the dominant sport in the United States. And he's saying this in 1921. Now, we'll hear this in the 70s. We hear it, you know, every time there's a major league started, somebody says this. But what's interesting is, and I was really surprised to read about this, as early as 1921, soccer's promoters in the United States are making that argument. And this league exists, again, it's mainly Sorry, you might have heard the dog, our dog come in and bark. So this league, the American Soccer League, exists. It's mainly, again, in the Northeast, Pennsylvania, New York, and especially Southern New England. It grew out of a Southern New England league. And its history is fascinating. But I want to give you a flavor for this league, David. So I'm going to read you the standings, the final table, the league table, as we'd say on this side, for the 1924-25 season. So coming in first were the Fall River Marksmen, Fall River, Massachusetts.
Jesus, okay.
Fall River. the Fall River Marksmen. Second was Bethlehem Steel, okay. Pennsylvania, yeah. Obviously associated with industry. Third were the Brooklyn Wanderers. Fourth, and I'd love a replica jersey of the Boston Boy Wonders. Fifth were the New Bedford Whalers.
Okay.
Again, you're seeing a theme here. Sixth were the Providence Clam Diggers.
Oh, that'd be great.
Seventh was J&P Coates from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. So here you have an industrial enterprise. Yeah. Eighth were the New York Giants. Ninth was Indiana Flooring, who presumably played a lot of road games. 10 was Fleischer Yam. 11 were the Newark Skeeters. And 12th was Philadelphia FC. Now, if you go back and you can go on Wikipedia and look up the American Soccer League, these are great team names, by the way. And what you get, as we often see in the period, in baseball history of this period, teams come up, they fold, they move, they change names, etc. But this gives you a sense about the flavor in terms of the team names, but more importantly, where they're located. So it's clearly associated with industry and in the Northeast mainly.
And it was baseball at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's where most of the major cities in the country were. The league pays really, really well. So Celtic here in Scotland lost their goalkeeper in the mid-1920s because I think he went to play for New Bedford.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Because they paid him more than Celtic were paying.
Really?
And the SFA, and again, I'm relying on Paul McFarlane's work in this, the SFA reports, there are in the sporting press here in Scotland, there are reports about the Yankee menace.
All right.
And the Yankee threat. So this league, which is now largely forgotten, except by soccer historians in the United States, and this league is seen as a threat to soccer here in the UK because there's a tension between over professionalism and they're paying more and they're paying players enough to lure them away from Scotland and England to go play in it. And so this is a going
so professional. Good players.
They are getting good players and it's a proper league. What happens though is FIFA, big bag FIFA, the international organization that governs world football, is worried about the threat and basically two of its members and both the Scottish FA and the English FA, football associations, had initially resisted FIFA. So there's a tension in the history of soccer, global soccer at this point, between FIFA, which is a French acronym, it's based on the continent, and the British associations. It's echoes of Brexit and all this kind of thing, but the British wanted to do their own thing. So there was tension originally in soccer's governing bodies between the British and FIFA. Once they've kind of patched things over, it's one reason why England doesn't participate in the first World Cups. Men's World Cups. Once these things are patched over, member associations are complaining about the danger posed by this league in the United States, the American Soccer League. And FIFA basically gives the United States Football Association, the governing body in the U.S., an ultimatum saying, you have to disavow this league. So there's tension between the sportocrats and the league itself.
And so what does the league do?
Eventually, the league, the USFA and FIFA disavow this league, and the league folds in 1933 during the Depression.
Right, sure.
So I think given the financial pressures of the Depression, plus the fact it doesn't have any sanction, this is important. It's called the Soccer War. And it's
Soccer War.
Yeah,
okay.
It's important because let's suppose the American Soccer League had survived.
Okay.
Which was possible.
Sure.
In the same way, the NFL was an embryonic entity in the 1920s, at this very same period. And, of course, it's gone on to become the global BM, or certainly the national BMF, and it's got a global footprint than it is today. It's probably the number one sporting entity in the United States today. It dwarfs everything else. If the American Soccer League had survived, you know, this is 25 years before the NBA is created. There's a space there for it, and possibly if this conflict hadn't happened with FIFA, it wouldn't. Then maybe the history of American soccer is different. We're not faced with there's always going to be a new dawn for American soccer, right? For as long as I've been alive, soccer's the next big thing, but it's always around the corner. Right. Well, there was a moment where that could have happened. 100 years ago, and the U.S. sporting landscape looks different. And one consequence of this is not just that it's a kind of route that American soccer didn't go down, but also at that point, that's where we see, because the sporting bureaucrats in FIFA are seen as foreign, and this is a moment of xenophobia in the United States. True. Basically, soccer becomes associated with foreigners and foreign meddling. And that's the end, seemingly, soccer as a professional entity in the United States. It's not true. There are semi-professional leagues throughout the 20th century, quite active and often associated both with immigrant populations, but also there are kind of native-born Americans who play, U.S. citizens who play a lot of soccer. So there are hotbeds around. St. Louis is a hotbed for soccer. The Pacific Northwest is. The Newark and Jersey City are, there are these hotbeds that remain throughout the 20th century, but soccer as a professional entity, as a major sport in the United States, that's a kind of option not taken in the 1920s and 30s. So there's a real missed opportunity there.
So when does it, I know there's been a bunch of times since then when they've tried to reintroduce professional soccer, ending up with MLS in, I guess, 1996. Yeah. What's between those two things?
Well, the big one in between is the North American Soccer League. Did you ever go to a New York Cosmos game when you were a kid?
No, my dad went, I think, before I was born and saw Pele and stuff.
Right. So I mean,
he was not a soccer guy, but he knew about who Pele was and thought that was worth
it. And it was a thing to do. And the Cosmos were a big deal. So you get the North American Soccer League in the 1970s. I remember going to see the New England T-Men play. They were owned by Lipton. It's not an inspiring name.
New England T-Men.
Better off with the New England Clam Diggers. I remember seeing the New England T-Men play, God, it must be 1977 or 78, something like that, in Foxborough, in the home of the New England Patriots. But the North American Soccer League was briefly popular, and there were some very good rivalries, some very good rivalry, in the Pacific Northwest between Vancouver and Seattle, which has been revived under MLS. And the New York Cosmos were the big team. But what the North American Soccer League did was self-consciously and deliberately bring in lots of European stars and international stars, usually who are past their sell-by dates.
Like Pele.
And pay them lots of money. The business model didn't work because they weren't really on TV very much. Pay them lots of money. So basically they were there to top up their pensions. The quality wasn't great. The spectacle was all right, I suppose, but it didn't quite work. But it coincided with the real boom in youth soccer in the United States, when youth soccer really took off, and has continued.
So that would be you.
That would be me, David.
Okay. So tell listeners about your illustrious football career.
I played soccer in elementary school, now everybody does elementary school.
But it was relatively new then.
Yeah.
I mean, or at least it seemed new.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember in my hometown there was a youth soccer program started by a guy who played in the North American Soccer League. But then played in junior high and high school. And it was a kind of thing you did. I mean, our school team wasn't great. Badly broke my leg playing school soccer, actually, when I was a senior in high school. So I missed most of my senior year in high school because I was in the hospital with a leg that I broke playing soccer. So I wouldn't call it an illustrious career, but it took off. And I remember in the 70s and 80s, there was all kinds of predictions. All these millions of kids who were playing youth soccer, it's going to go on. It's America. It's going to take off. And the culmination of that kind of phase was probably the 94 World Cup, which the United States hosted. And this was meant to be you know, the English always talk about football coming home. This was meant to be kind of football really taking off in the United States. And the 94 World Cup was a success on a sporting level, and the U.S. did okay. And there were a lot of fans there, but it was a bit of a false dawn. I think the creation of MLS in 1996, and MLS has a different model than the old North American Soccer League did. So what it's done, there are still kind of former stars, old players from abroad coming in and topping up their pensions. But what they've also done is they're developing a lot of both U.S. and international players who then go on elsewhere, come to Europe to play and play in more competitive leagues. They've got a good TV contract. It's definitely watchable. The fans are great. The fan bases are great. I mean, some of the biggest crowds in the world on any given weekend are in places like Atlanta and Portland watching games. So the fan culture is different. So MLS has a much more successful model. They're not trying to compete with the Premier League. They're seeing themselves as a kind of supplement to it. One of the things that's really happened in the U.S., I think, is, and I've seen this in the time I've been gone, soccer's always been a little weird and kind of an affectation to follow in America. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I mean, it used to be kind of hipsters followed it, right? And things like this. And that's still an element of that, but
it's less true than it used to be.
It's mainstream.
Yeah.
Every, you know, whenever I'm in the U.S., I'm struck. If I put the TV on in the hotel on a Saturday or Sunday morning, Premier League's on.
Or if you go to a sports bar, you know, 20 years ago you wouldn't have seen football, soccer on the screen, but now you will.
Right, and there are bars in New York where you can go watch Liverpool or Man City or whatever, Arsenal, or Real Madrid. And so there's a proper kind of culture around soccer is taken, a kind of indigenous culture, soccer culture in the United States that I think has changed things. So I think, I won't say the false dawn, like, well, this is the real dawn, because they've been predicting this since 1920. But it does seem as though after a century that there's a legitimate kind of both significant fan base, but also a kind of playing culture.
Well, I think one of the things that struck me just in the little bit of research I was able to do for this episode, as opposed to the lifetime of research you've been doing, you know, I was thinking about the 1970s and thinking about this North American Soccer League as being sort of one of the pivots towards mainstreaming soccer in the United States. I guess the other thing, thinking about the women's sport, which we haven't talked much about, is the introduction of Title IX in 1972 and the role that had on women's soccer, in as much as for the background, Title IX requires that educational funding be distributed equally along gender lines, including for sports. And many universities decided that women's soccer was basically the way that they could counterbalance the American or the men's football team, American football team. And so you have a tremendous growth in college women's soccer. Any idea how many women's soccer teams there were at universities in 1971?
I don't know.
There were 13 teams in the entire country.
Right, okay.
With 313 players. Now there are more than 1,000 teams and 28,000 players.
Right, and what you see with the youth soccer boom that began in the 70s and 80s, of course, that was co-educational.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas boys often got kind of siphoned off into other sports in high school that might have more cachet, baseball, football, basketball, whatever, hockey. Girls tended to stick with soccer. So you had this pipeline going in, and then because of Title IX, and we see this, you know, the American men are okay at soccer. The American women are the best in the world.
And have been for a very long time.
Yeah, it's not going to last, though. I'm going to tell you why in a second.
Okay.
But it's exactly a product of Title IX, and it's also a key element to this whole story, because the fandom for soccer in the United States is, you know, is not confined to a single gender or group, and so the fandom is both men and women, and that's really an important part of the story. But that's because the participation hasn't been confined.
Now, why aren't the American women going to stay dominant?
So the American women have been great, and they've won. In fact, they've been so good, their fans are kind of obnoxious, which means you've arrived. I mean, they've won 4 of the 8 Women's World Cups. Mm-hmm. So the Women's World Cup was introduced in 1991, and the American women, the U.S. women, have won 4 of those, and I think they've finished 2nd another time and 3rd. You know, they have been really, really good, and this is a direct result of all that investment in Title IX. Mm-hmm. And so those women's players went and played, have gone on to play and had great, great success. And I want to be clear about this. I'm not saying they're not going to continue to be competitive. They will be. What we've seen, so you've seen Bend It Like Beckham, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of Bend It Like Beckham, how's the movie end?
I don't remember. Sorry.
They're going off to play in America, the two women in the movie, because they got scholarships to play in the U.S.,
okay.
Which is the Title IX story, right? And for a long time, that was the story. And if you look at those early World Cups, Women's World Cups, they're dominated by the U.S. and basically the Germans and Scandinavians. Mm-hmm. They're dominated by the countries that really put money into women's sports for mm-hmm. whatever reason, either because they were enlightened or because they had to for legal reasons,
sure. Like,
as happened in the United States. What's happening now is the rest of the world is catching up. This is good.
Oh, yeah. It's not the American team is getting worse. It's everyone else.
No. Everybody else is getting better. And so the England women's team, who won the European Championships recently defeated the U.S. women in a friendly. It was a friendly, but they did. You know, they are now on a par, arguably. And we'll see this in next. There's going to be a World Cup next year, a Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand. I think the amount of money involved and the amount of money that's being invested in Europe in women's football. So all the big European clubs, Manchester City, Juventus, Real Madrid, all have women's clubs now and all have competitive leagues. The Women's Super League, which is the Women's Premier mm-hmm. League, is on TV here in the UK, but you probably haven't seen it, but gets, you know, here in Scotland, Hearts and Hibs, there was an Edinburgh Derby the other day at Easter Road. It was the biggest crowd to ever see a women's professional game in Scotland. The crowds are big. The TV money, the TV audiences are there. The money is good. The money is actually better than what you're getting in professional women's soccer in the United States. I think the leagues are probably more competitive. All of this augurs well for women's football generally. Mm. But I think the era of kind of unquestioned U.S. women's dominance is ending. It's not that they won't be competitive. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in next year's Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand. I think the American women, who are a little bit cocky, and their fans certainly are, some of the most obnoxious in world football, might be in for a shock. I'm predicting that right now.
Well, I hope there's some good games played.
There will be very good games, and I want them to win. Of course, I support them, but I think that they better be prepared. I think and undoubtedly the people running U.S. women's football or soccer know what they're doing. They're good, and they will have seen this. And of course, American players are playing abroad. They're playing for teams they're playing in these leagues. But the point is, it's a whole lot more competitive, and that's good. Just as in the early men's World Cups. Mm. Weren't all that competitive, and it was kind of who bothered to show up and all that. It's better when it's more competitive, but I think the era of American women's hegemony in football is coming to an end.
Now, how would you, given the growth in soccer in the United States, it's still not as big as American football or as baseball or as basketball yet. It's getting closer, but it's not quite there. When do you think it will sort of become on par with those sports in terms of their prominence, in terms of the amount the athletes get paid, in terms of those kinds of things?
I mean, how do you measure this? It's difficult to measure relative importance. I mean, I think...
Well, you can't do it in terms of, like, how much these guys are getting paid to do the thing.
Sure, but I don't, because there are so many leagues in soccer, so are you actually, so is it appropriate to compare the salaries of NFL players with the salaries of MLS players, or do you compare the salaries of NFL players to the salaries of players in the Premier League?
Fair point.
You know, because it is a global marketplace, so, you know, it's not as though it exists in a vacuum, but I think soccer's probably, and I love hockey. I loved hockey growing up. I played hockey, but ice hockey, that is. Soccer's bigger in the United States than ice hockey now. I think I don't know how you measure this, but I think I'm pretty confident in saying that. Baseball is my favorite sport, but it's got an aging demographic and doesn't seem to be growing. The NFL seems to be in a position of total dominance and is today, but given the kind of the head injury issues and so, you know, some of the aspects, you know, there are some real concerns about.
I have a hard time watching American football.
Football has got all kinds of problems. It seems to be that the basketball is the other is you know, if we could cast our minds. So I'm like that guy in 1921 predicting global or U.S. Becoming a soccer country. I think if we look to the end of this century, I suspect that the two most popular sports on earth will probably be basketball, soccer and basketball in that order. Because again, the barrier to entry for basketball is very low and anybody can play it and everything else. So whereas football seems to be dominant at the moment, but I wonder how long that will last. But sorry, I'm not really answering your question. Yeah. It seems to, but I've never thought it was a zero-sum game. So in other words, I think soccer's got a firmly established place in the firmament now in the United States and in the sporting culture of the United States, which is, it's a lot like Australia in this, where there are a lot of sports that people play and there are kind of sports that outsiders don't understand and think, why do they do that? But, you know, that people are happy with. I don't think baseball is going to disappear, even if it's not as popular as it was 50 years ago. But I think soccer's place is firmly ensconced. And I think, you know, Americans do like success. One reason the women's soccer took off in the United States is because the American woman won in that, you know, 30 years ago.
Americans like winners.
Everybody likes winners. But so if the U.S., you know, if the U.S. were to beat the Netherlands this weekend, you know, people will get on board with this team. You know, Joe Biden announced the win over Iran last night. So people will notice it, and so success breeds success. The World Cup is coming back to North America in 2026. So it's going to be jointly held, hosted by Canada, the United States, and Mexico, which is really interesting. It's going to be great. And I think the contrast between that and 1994, when it was really seen as, okay, this is FIFA trying to explore a new region and establish. Well, first of all, the Canadians were very unlucky not to have better results in this World Cup. So the Canadians have a really good team, young team, very promising. The Americans do. Mexico's always good. I think the North America is now an important soccer heartland, even if snooty Europeans don't want to acknowledge it.
All right.
So two takeaways.
Two takeaways.
Where men's soccer is concerned, Americans are snotty about America. And they shouldn't be. Europeans, rather, are snotty about America and shouldn't be. Where women's soccer is concerned, Americans are a little too cocky and arrogant and ought to show a little more humility.
Right. Okay, so American football fans, soccer fans listening, that was Frank's comments, not mine. You can direct your hate mail at him. Right.
The American women should not have beat Thailand 13-0 in the last World Cup. That was bad. That was really graceless. And the fans were pretty obnoxious about it. And I haven't forgotten.
Okay. Frank does not forget. He does not forgive. Maybe he forgives, but he doesn't forget. All right. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
I want to pay tribute to two of our listeners, David.
All right.
So they've come to my attention.
Both of them listeners. Okay. So
two of our listeners, and they are not the usual listeners. So one of them is not Mimi in this case. So I had a message, very nice message from a former colleague who's now in Australia, and he told me that one of his students at Monash University loves this podcast, and it's their favorite podcast.
That is remarkable.
I don't know their name, but I think we want to say hello to
listeners in Australia.
To our listener in Melbourne down in Monash University. So thank you for listening. And the other is, I was at an event in New York recently, an alumni event, and a former student of mine, a former dissertation student of mine, Brittany, came up, and she mentioned that she listens to the podcast as well and continues to listen. So we want to thank all of our listeners, but I want to give a special shout out to Brittany and the unnamed listener in Australia.
Okay.
What about you, David? What have you got?
A couple weeks ago was the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, and every year they have an event in Gettysburg to commemorate this with a number of people giving papers and whatnot. And there was a very interesting paper that was given by a guy who teaches at UNC Asheville about the location of the Gettysburg Address. And since he gave the address, there have been debates about exactly where it is Lincoln stood. And there's a monument there, and the monument, most people now realize, is in the wrong place. For a while, tour guide said, no, it's over in this other location. And this guy, a guy named Christopher Oakley, did a whole bunch of computer modeling to try to figure out where Lincoln stood based on a handful of photos that were taken the day of the address, not of the address itself, because note that we don't have any pictures of Lincoln actually giving it, but of other events during that day. And based on computer modeling and a lot of math and stuff and some very clever detective work, he has his own theory that seems to be fairly persuasive about where it is Lincoln stood. Now, doesn't matter at all where Lincoln stood. That's a totally, as trivia goes, that's the epitome of it. But I guess some people like to know and go visit the actual spot. So,
are there any like Gettysburg truthers out there who are claiming he wasn't there at all or anything like that? Are there any conspiracies around it?
Not to that extent, but there are people who take these things in, Gettysburg is considered, sacred ground for some people, and they take these things very seriously about where particular people stood at particular moments in time. Obviously it doesn't really matter. The content of the speech is matters more than where physically he stood, but the detective work that goes into figuring out where he may have stood is fascinating.
Yeah, indeed. So sorry, before we wrap up, what's your take on the content of the speech? I mean, does the Gettysburg Address deserve its reputation? I mean, it's probably the most important speech in American history, either that or Martin Luther King's at March on Washington. Sorry, this is a topic for another episode.
The speech is actually, the big speech given that day, that lasted for 2 hours, was given by Edward Everett. That was the speech that people were actually going to pay attention to. Lincoln gave what was essentially the benediction. I think part of the reason why that speech has the place in American culture that it does is that it was taught a lot in schools in the late 19th century because it's really short. It's 272 words, and so it's the kind of thing you can have students recite in class. So I think it's an important speech in terms of its rhetorical value. It's a very poetic speech, but it's barely in my top five Lincoln speeches.
But now, we're wrapping this up, but we have to have David's top five
Lincoln speeches. Yes.
All right, we definitely need to return to this as an episode. Now, as if you need a proof that this is not scripted, you've just had it. Okay. So that's interesting. I'm intrigued.
Well, I mean, because I think in terms of it's a very poetic speech, but I think there's other speeches Lincoln gives which are more significant in terms of actually articulating policy and having meaningful consequences to the speech. The response to the speech at the time was Lincoln said a few things. Oh well.
Fascinating. Okay, obviously this is a whole different episode, so we have to wrap this up. But I'm so because I would push back a little bit. Mm. I'm not a Lincoln specialist, of course. I defer to your expertise. So even I am of the view. Okay, it doesn't matter where he stood in Gettysburg. But the fact he was in Gettysburg in the aftermath of that battle saying those words, does that context not matter?
I think it's an interesting speech, but he gave lots of similar kinds of speeches in the aftermath of battles, right. To say, look, we need to mourn people who are dead because that's what you do in wars. I think the first inaugural is more important. The speech at Cooper Union is more important. I think the second inaugural is more important. I think the message to Congress he gives is there's a bunch of other speeches.
I've got five. I've had counted five there. A
couple of the Lincoln Douglas debate speeches are interesting, in terms of him saying things that are worthy of. I think the Gettysburg is worthy of literary analysis because it's a very poetic speech and it has some ramifications. But I think there are other speeches he gives that are more significant or seem more significant at the time.
Okay. All right.
All right. On that note,
cheers.
We talk more like that. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.